Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Forms and Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, connecting the history one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
I jumped the gun. Good evening, everybody. This is Professor Gary Lee, and this is the AMMA Masters Pioneers Radio Network and Blog. And Parts Unknown is the name of our show. We thank you for letting us come in your home this evening. It's a beautiful Tuesday in Texas, and by the way, my producer, Mr. Hansi Bowens, in North Carolina, and we're going to be interviewing our special guest tonight, Mr. Joe Ribello. He's up in Massachusetts. So we're going to be bouncing around America tonight, but we'll bring in on Mr. Ribello in just a little while. But before we do, I have 30 seconds of silence that we need to do for someone very special who was part of America Martial Arts. We lost recently, just in the past couple of days ago, Mr. John Townsley. And John Townsley was instrumental in sport karate in the early years, especially in the USKA. Later on in his latter years, he worked with the Pan Concretion Association around the world, and had some incredible sons, Peter and Scott, and his lovely wife, Mary, was a photographer for sport martial arts around America for many, many, many years. So at this time, I would like to give our Sport Karate Museum and Masters Radio Blog Network respect and give 30 seconds of silence to Master John Townsley. Rest in peace. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I'm going to start off tonight with something really exciting. This weekend, I went to the Jamal Nationals, and I had a really fun time. We had an epic event at the Jamal Nationals here in Houston. It's something that really happened that's important for sport karate. I met with my old friend, Mr. Alex Reyes. Now, if you don't know Alex, Alex does the Point Fighter Radio, and he covers all the karate tournaments around America. And he's got like a radio program, a television live feed, and he's just an incredible individual. And he really cares about what's going on in martial arts America today. And we sat and talked for a long time, and we came together on a calibration that I will help him as much as I can, and he's going to help the Sport Karate Museum as much as he can to get the word out that we're really working together. So to my dear friend Alex Reyes from Point Fighter Radio, I got one word to say to you, and that's power, baby, power, and that's his famous word. So we're very, very excited to welcome Point Fighter Radio to our network and be able to talk about some of the things. And for information on upcoming tournaments and tournaments are to be, please go to Point Fighter Radio on Facebook, and make sure you tell them the Sport Karate Museum sent you and Masters Radio Network sent you. And that's our dear friend, Mr. Alex Reyes. Now, also, we had this weekend a very unique situation happen, and a parent came up to the steeple, I'm going to say that, and decided to take on a sponsorship of a player and sponsor this player for a full ride in the NBL and the WKC and the NASCAR circuits, starting with the U.S. Open. Now, it's not so much important about who the player is. It's important that it's about parents. And what it was is the Sport Karate Museum this weekend created a new award. It's called the Parents Reward. And this is where a parent steps up, picks out a producer and a competitor, and rewards them. And this year, those two recipients received $1,000 and also a $17,000 sponsorship for the U.S. Open and Disneyland package. So thank you for the parents across America. And hopefully next year, you might be one of those parents that gets chosen for the Sport Karate Museum Parent Award. We've got some really incredible events coming up, and normally I talk about this in the middle of the show, but I'm so excited about what's going on. I want to cover them right now at the game before I bring on Mr. Ribello. In 2 weeks, history again is going to be made across America. It's going to be the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Atlanta. And there's not only the tournament, which is so prestigious and built up over the years and taken out by Truth Enterprises, or Mr. Truth is basically Ruth. I'm sorry, Ruth, taking the Battle of Atlanta to a higher level. But on Friday night, June 15th, at the hotel where everything is at, Mr. Joe Corley, Mr. Jeff Smith, Mr. Bill Wallace has put together a reunion of martial artists and players from around the country over 50 years, 40 years from the PKA, but honoring the one and only great Joe Louis and handpicking various people from the Heroes of Sport Karate to give them personally the Joe Louis External Award. It is something not to be missed. So if you'd like to go back down history and see some incredible fighters that you used to see on ESPN, all the great television shows from the 80s and so on, they're going to be in Atlanta June the 15th at Mr. Corley's event and the gathering for the Joe Louis Eternal Awards. Please, for more information, contact Mr. Joe Corley on Facebook, and he'll give you all the details. We're 2 weeks away from that. You know, then right around the corner, August the 3rd, will be the Who's Food Banquet. And this is the event correlated with the August 3rd, 4th, and 5th of the Dennis Brown's U.S. Capitol Classics. And it's going to be pretty exciting. They brought in Dan Severin, UFC champion, known as the Beast, Cynthia Rothrock, my dear friend Dana Abbott, who's writing my screenplay, my character for my book, and the movie that we're doing. Cynthia Rothrock will be there also. And my also dear friend, Mr. John Chung. And this is surrounded by not only a banquet, but awards banquet, and also seminars and all kinds of cool things that Auntie Jesse Bowen puts together. And this year we're celebrating the new book, which was taken from the old venue. And it's called The Legends and Masters and Pioneers of Martial Arts, Identity of this new book. And we're introducing this new format. And it still has the same attitude. We want your story. We want your story, what you did in America. So that's August the 3rd. And more information, please contact Mr. Jesse Bowen on Facebook, and he'll give you all the details. August the 15th, 16th, we'll be back in Houston for the Universal Hall of Fame, Martial Arts Hall of Fame, put on Mr. Severa Guerrero. This is one of the oldest original Hall of Fames in the country, and actually in the first years of the 90s, early 90s, quite a few years back, I was the Master of Ceremonies. Vice President Daryl Stewart's a big part of this, and Severa Guerrero has worked together, put together a great, great event. Seminars, I'll be there. Along with Mr. Hattifield, I believe a combat specialist, we do seminars as we get closer. I'll tell you about more of the seminars will be coming. And ending out this adventure in marketing as we're talking about events will be the famous Kata Wars, and introducing this year the Jim Harrison's American Challenge. Imagine a three-man team match between guys and girls, not fighting each other, but having team matches, three-person team matches, and also having fun in front of the legends. So much fun. More fun than a battle should have. And that's September the 28th and 29th, along with Mikey Rowe-Moore's Celebrity Roast. They have Kata Wars, Jim Harrison America's Challenge, the largest sport karate museum display in the country. Oh, just an incredible fun time. Again, I mentioned Darlene McPherson's Women's Symposium. We're bringing all kinds of powerful ladies around the country together in one room. That's going to be really interesting. So please, mark your calendar, September the 28th and 29th, Kata Wars and the Jim Harrison's American Challenge, Living Legends 26, the Ohana Gathering. Now, my special guest tonight, he is known as Kenpo Joe, and he is known as a historian. Well, we're going to see how much Kenpo history he knows. We'll ask him some really good questions. I hope that he can answer them. And just for the record, we're going to be talking about his history, but for people who don't know, who hasn't dug deep maybe in my personal history, my first black belt, third-degree black belt, came from Jack Farr. Not my first black belt, but my third-degree black belt came from Chinese Kenpo. And Jack Farr, as we were talking earlier, was the first man that was sponsored by Coors. And he was a top-rated competitor. And he was directly under Mr. Parker. So that is my lineage. And if I remember right, my certificate was signed by Scotty Baum, John Townsley, Rick Fowler, Dan Anderson, and, of course, Jack Farr. And so my Kenpo knowledge is a little bit. So we're going to be asking some good questions to Kenpo Joe, and we're going to be bringing on Mr. Joe Ribello on right now. So, Mr. Ribello, are you there?
Yes, Gary, thank you so much for inviting me on the program. I greatly appreciate it, and really looking forward to talking to you about one of my my great love in life, the martial arts.
Well, I appreciate that, and particularly the Kempo lineage and the Kempo history. You know, I appreciate you being on the show tonight. May I call you Kempo Joe or Joe, please?
Sure, either whatever you're most comfortable with. Again, you know,
thank
I never
you.
Thought
thank
a screen
you.
Name would actually become who I am, you know?
Yes, sir. But I like Kempo Joe. It kind of backs up what I said about you for these past 2 weeks before I get you on the air live. First of all, where did the Kempo Joe name come from?
Well, actually, America Online. Way back when America Online was first being put together, I got involved with
That was the WWW thing, right?
Well, you know, back then it was, like I said, it was originally AOL, and they gave out the little discs, and I had one of my students who was repaired computers and built computers. And I had another friend of mine who was very much involved in the internet, and he turned me on to the various websites on the internet and America Online. And I had my student introduce me to AOL through one of the disks and put it on my computer and got involved on the internet. And one of the first people
well, who
originally
named you Kempo Joe. Who named you
well,
Kempo
I came
Joe?
Well, I came up with trying it. Originally, Kempo Joe wasn't available, so I had to use Kempo Joe 1. And okay. with the number one after it. And
okay.
at the time, if you weren't active on AOL with a particular screen name for a particular amount of time, I think it was like 6 months to a year,
right.
they yanked your account and they made that name available again. So
okay.
I was Kempo Joe 1 for a while, and there was a lady by the name of Kempo Cars, who I can now mention, Kathleen Neelock out of Springfield, Mass. And she was Kempo Cars, and she helped run the martial arts channel for America Online. And
okay.
After about between 6 months to a year, I kept checking AOL, and then one day, BIP, and if I'm not mistaken, it was actually Joe Polanzo, who was the head of the Worldwide Kempo Karate Association,
sure,
who actually
Joe.
Had that screen
yeah.
name. But he didn't do
okay.
much with it. He didn't do anything with it. So the name became available because of disuse. And
right.
so one day I came in and, you know, I kept checking and, bip, Kempo Joe is available. So I grabbed it. And
good. Well, listen, where'd you make black belt at? Who did you make black belt under?
Oh, it depends on the art. The first.
Stop.
My,
let's
my
stop.
First.
Okay, I'm gonna keep everything simple. In Kempo,
okay.
What year did you make black belt and who did you make black belt under?
Well, actually, that was the first black belt I really made my black belt in. Basically what happened back in 1975, I started up with United Studios of Self-Defense. Now, the original one that Fred Villari had originally created with
Mr. Matera, right?
No, wrong. Incorrect.
Okay.
That is not correct. That is not accurate. No.
Again, well, who owned that before he did?
Well, hold on. Let me get that. Let's correct your history. So, United Studios of Self-Defense was originally created in the late 1960s into early 70s by Frederick J. Villari and his business associate, Rudy Horn. They were both students of Nick Serio. Now, Nick Serio at the time had relocated from his Rhode Island roots to Florida. Because of that, Fred Villari, along with Rudy Horn, got together and they opened up two studios in Waltham and Dedham, Massachusetts. Now, again, their original intention was to be a Nick Serio Kenpo franchise. Nick Serio got disillusioned with Florida, moved back to Rhode Island. Again, he was approached by Fred Villari and Rudy Horn. Look, we've got these two schools. We want to make them Nick Serio franchises. And he's like, what do you mean you have these two schools? Why don't you contact me ahead of time when I was down in Florida? And they had a big falling out, and Fred Villari and Rudy Horn left Nick Serio. And
Wait a minute. Go back. Go back. You're telling me Kempo people had a falling out? Give me a break.
And the sun rises in the east, and bears defecate in the forest. And
right.
I hate to be bursting so many
question.
Of your bubbles in, one,
Joe,
in just
Joe,
the beginning.
Here's
talking.
My question. Joe, here's my question. I know of United Fighting, what you just said, is being owned by Matera. When did he get involved?
Well, I'm getting to that. So,
Charlie
Matera got involved.
Okay.
Yep, Charlie Matera got involved with Fred Villari in the, I was going to say, the late 60s to early 70s.
Okay.
Now, I forget right off the top of my head. I believe he was also a black belt with Nick Serio. I don't recall exactly how it went, but I do know that Charlie Matera went with Fred Villari. Matter of fact, I have a newspaper from the original United Students of Self-Defense, which shows Charlie Matera in 1975 being promoted to fourth degree black belt by Fred Villari.
Okay.
So
cool.
He was with Fred way back in the infancy of United Studios. Now, at the time, I had started in 1974 in one of the first 20 United Studios franchises in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And I was studying with a gentleman by the name of Fred E. Hosmer, who normally went as Ed Hosmer, so he wouldn't be confused with Fred Villari. And not that it was a bad thing, he just wanted to, you know, be known as himself and not be confused with people asking, well, who's Fred? Well, he was, but it was wrong Fred. But anyway, I was training with him, and I got all the way up to my blue belt, and unfortunately, Mr. Hosmer left the studio, and they went through a series of different instructors taking over that location, but I really enjoyed being with Mr. Hosmer. A while afterwards, that particular studio closed down, so I was bouncing back and forth to different martial arts and studying everything from Tang Sudo, Taekwondo.
Okay, but when did you make black belt in Kempo? What year? That's why I
asked. Well, I'm getting to that.
10 minutes ago.
So long story short, I'm literally studying multiple arts at the same time, and I meet up with the assistant instructor at USSD, whose name was James Gagnon. So he asked me, well, how come you never got your black belt? I said, well, the school closed. And I was like, you interested? I was, oh, yeah. So I trained with him, and I tested in January of 1983 for my black belt with him. But I wasn't alone. There was another gentleman, Leo Lassert, who was a kung fu, Southern style kung fu instructor in New Bedford. And I had worked with him for a short time in that particular style of kung fu. And then his instructor left the area. He didn't have a place where he basically worked out in his basement. So I got him in touch with Jim Gagnon.
1981, you made black belt?
1983, January of 1983.
Okay,
that's when I got my black
belt. That answered my question. Okay. Now, your black belt, 1983 in Kempo. Now, Kempo actually came from Hawaii in the early 60s, of course, with Ms. Parker. Now, there's a 20-year span there. Now, you're a historian in Kempo. You're a historian from 60 years to 80, or are you just a Kempo historian from 81 to the present?
As far as when I became, quote-unquote, an official historian, I always joke around, what's official, you know?
I'm
fascinated.
Because I'm not going to ask you questions that you don't have the answer to, and I was going to ask you some questions that go back to the 60s and 70s, and out of respect.
Yeah, you can certainly go back. All the way back to day one, not a problem. I can if I can't answer them, I'll let you know. But other than that, it's a lot more than
day
just
one,
the 80s.
Okay, day one. Okay, I understand. So here we go. Day one. When did you meet Mr. Parker?
Sure. I mentioned about Leo Lassert. After we tested for our black belt, Leo Lassert, myself, another guy, Ron Valliere, Leo Lassert contacted Mr. Parker. Again, we thought we were doing Ed Parker's Kempo. What we were doing was the lineage from Karazempo Goshin Jutsu, from Sonny Gascon, down through George Pasari, down through Nick Serio, down through Fred Villari, that particular lineage of Kenpo. But we'd bowed a flag, we'd bowed a Professor Chow, who obviously, a picture of Professor Chow was on the wall, and that was Ed Parker's instructor, so we thought we were doing, Chow's Ed Parker's system. And he contacted Ed Parker in 1983, and right around that time, Nick Serio, who originally had worked with Mr. Parker in the late 1960s with the IKKA at one point, and Tony and Doreen Cogliandro and Kalai Griffin and all these people, they got together and they contacted Mr. Parker about having him reactivate the IKKA in New England. So it all worked out. We just happened to, Leo just happened to contact him at the right time, and they started in their infancy, and that's when I first got to meet Mr. Parker.
Super. Okay, good answer. Thank you. Now, here's my question. Now you realize that you're not doing the Ed Parker American Kempo system. You're doing the lineage of Mr. Serio. By the way, I idolized him, and I was very close to Matthew. Rest in peace. And I believe that there's definitely that's two systems. But then you throw in Mr. Tracy, Mr. Al Tracy, broke away from Mr. Parker years and years ago and formed his Tracy system. When did you get involved with Mr. Tracy? Because I know you're involved. You
were involved that was long after Mr. Parker died. That was many years.
Okay,
yeah,
way
what
after
was,
Mr. Parker passed away. Okay.
Yes, I didn't contact Mr. Tracy until after Mr. Parker had died. Several years
yes.
after Mr. Parker died, actually.
Okay, let's go to Mr. Tracy. I won't say that. Let's go back to Mr. Parker died. Rest in peace, Mr. Parker. Now, here's my first parts unknown hardcore question to you. I know for a fact people like Mr. Tatum, Mr. Palanzo, and I can think of a couple others, immediately promoted themselves to 10th degree black belt. And they did that because Mr. Parker is gone, and there was not really any group that says, you're doing that. Now, Mr. Parker, am I correct? He never claimed to be a 10th degree black belt. Is that correct?
Well, first of all, let's go over a couple of points and clarify. Neither Larry Tatum nor Joe Palanzo did this immediately after Ed Parker died. It was a few years down the road.
A few years. What is a few years? 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, what?
Well, again, Mr. Tatum parted from Mr. Parker in the mid-1980s. He then put together the videotapes that he did for Panther Productions. Honestly, Mr. Tatum didn't do any promotion until after Mr. Parker died, and I want to say right off the top of my head, I don't know the exact date, but I want to say at least, I had gone to see him in Pasadena in 1995, and he had just recently done it, so I would say 1994, okay. 1995, that Mr. Tatum did that.
Okay, super. Now, my next question is, who promoted him?
Well, when I originally spoke to him on New Year's Day in 1995, he had stated at that time that his students had gotten together and said, look, you really should be this rank, et cetera. I have heard a different story since then. I can only relay to the story that Mr. Tatum said to me at that time. I did record it at that time, but unfortunately there's a problem with the audio with my camera, which I wasn't aware of. So I got
a lot of questions, Joe, so I'm going to go to the next question that deals with this. Who promoted Joe Palanzo to 10th degree black belt?
No one. He promoted himself. I have the letter, which states the following. Huh?
Who was the next person in Kempo, other than those two important people, promoted themselves to 10th degree black belt in Kempo?
Well, there were several people that did it around that time. I literally have to look chronologically as who point by point by point did it when.
I understand.
Yeah, that I would have to. Yeah, I really would have to detail that out.
Do you agree? Okay, now that we've established that when Mr. Parker passed away, everybody that was in that particular ranking position said, well, no one's going to look around my shoulder. I don't care. I've done it. I'm going to promote myself at 10th degree black belt. So what happened was it became a domino effect because here's my pet peeve. I've got 37-year-old men calling me and telling me they're 9th and 10th degree black belts in Kempo, and they want to know why they're not part of the Sport Karate Museum. And I don't pull punches when it comes to Kempo. So my point, and I'm excited to have you on the show because I know you're very – very honest with me, and you've been my friend for many years. So I want to really be blunt about this. I'm curious to see what happened in the Kempo community where everybody said, okay, no one's going to cover, no one cares. I'm going to promote myself to 10th degree black belt, and no one's going to do anything about it. So you got all these 10th degree black belts now running around in Kempo Karate, and really it's a laughing stock to the martial art community. It really is. Because you've got the difference between Kempo and Kempo, which is still Chinese, and then you got the Kaji Kempo guys, which they're a totally different group of animals. I'm just curious how you feel about that. All these 10th degree black belts are running around in Kempo, and it's embarrassing.
Well, like I said, you know, there's a classic phrase that we both know. There are black belts, and then there are black belts. There are people that are legitimate as the day is long, who have constantly strived to do everything they could to be the best that they could be.
The public don't know that. Joe, Kippo Joe, the public doesn't know that. The public just sees a guy put a temporary black belt certificate on his window, and he starts selling karate.
Well, again, I don't agree with it. I'm just stating that's one of the aspects regarding it. Like I said, I still have the letter from that someone passed along from the WKKA, and I'll never forget the line. To preserve the integrity of the arts, I am promoting myself to 10th degree black belt. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what the letter said at that time. So because he was the head of his particular organization, they felt that in regards, again, to their particular organization, that if they were going to promote people to lower degrees of black belt, that they in turn would have to be 10th degree black belt. Now, I want to clarify a very important point.
Okay.
Go ahead. Okay. Again, the point I want to clarify is the fact that Mr. Parker provided for the fact that there be other 10th degree black belts. I love people said that, well, he was only a bit. No. Even Ed Parker himself stated that there should be a board of black belts, and his goal was to have a board of 10th degree black belts. That's why he was originally listed as senior grandmaster. And now I see people all over the place using the term senior grandmaster. And Dennis Knatzer, right, a mutual friend of ours, came up with a great phrase of founding grandmaster. And that's the whole thing, like in Kung Fu circles. If you're the founder, you're above rank. You're above all that rank structure. You founded the system. You know, in Chinese, in Cantonese, they say Sijo. You know, you're the founder. You're above all that stuff. And, you know, that's what Ed Parker was. But
I agree with that, 100%. I agree with that. But going back to my feeling that we're talking about, Kempo and Kempo, we have two spellings, and it's the only system that has that, K-E-N-P-O, K-E-M-P-O. And I'm not talking about black belts or your students that understand what Kempo is and understanding of it. I'm talking about to the general public that look at martial arts, and they're confusing about that. And my point is that when they see someone that says they're a 50 black belt and they're 35 years old, and then they understand what real traditional karate is, it's embarrassing, Kempo Joe. So how do we do it? How do we stop this Kempo invasion of 10th degree black belts in America? If you've got to put a board together, is there a board together now that governs that within Kempo?
Or well, by the same token, how do you stop all the Shotokan guys who want JKA?
I'm not talking about
Shotokan. How do you stop
Shotokan.
The Taekwondo guys
I'm
who, I mean, it's a similar
Shotokan.
Scenario.
I'm not talking about Shotokan. I'm talking about Kempo. Shotokan's got their own world. I'm talking about the Kempo guys because, you know me, my Kempo is my heart. And it hurts me to see what people say about it because they don't understand it. And then the guys within the frame of what Kempo is, they abuse it. They misuse it.
Well,
you know,
let's first of all address your first point. All right. The term Kempo or Kenpo. Okay. Again, Mandarin Chinese, the term is chuanfa, means the law of the fist, not the way of the fist, not the fist method. I see that people mention that all the time. No, it specifically talks about the law of the fist. And that law is our natural laws that we understand in relationship to motion and action and self-defense. Now, from that point, it travels to Okinawa. Now, I'm half Portuguese, half Puerto Rican. And in Spanish, the dialect for my name is yo me llamo. But when you look at the Puerto Rican dialect, they say yo me llamo. In Ryukyu Islands, in Okinawa, when they looked at the Chinese calligraphy, and again, remember, they're a centralized location between China, Korea, and Japan. So they're a big center point for mercantilism, perpetuating, promoting religion, all these various aspects. And they're getting all these different languages being spoken to them. And they also have their own native language, Hogun. So they look at the character and they say, okay, Chuan. All right, if I deal with the Japanese, they say Ken. So I'm like, okay, we can. And then I look at the word for law. And what's the word for law? Okay, basic context, it's po. Okay, so it's kenpo. Now, the Japanese look at them and say, oh, silly Okinawans. No, 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 no. In Japanese syntax, when you put that character for ken next to the character for po, it changes the N sound to an M sound. Good. And I sit there and say, the Okinawans, A, didn't know any better, used their own native language as a foundation and format. So when you say kenpo with an N, it normally refers to the Okinawan influence systems. Not always, but as a rule. When you say kenpo with an M, it refers to the Japanese orientation. Oh, by the way, in most Japanese martial arts, when you say kenpo to them, what they think of is kung fu. They think of wushu. They think of guoshu. They think of Chinese-based martial arts. Now, by the same token, in many circles in China, Okinawa, and Japan, when you say chuanfa or kenpo or kempo, they think of that as a negative connotation for street fighting. They think of guys out in the alley beating each other's heads in. They think of people curb stomping people and smash each other with trash cans. That's what their analogy and connotation is of kenpo, which in many ways
is cool?
Far off.
Kenpo Joe, listen, Kenpo Joe, you know what's really cool? The history lesson that you just taught my listeners. But here's my point. These 35-year-old 10th degree black belts in kenpo, they have no idea what you just said.
As I always say, here's a quarter, go buy a clue. Here's a dime, call someone who cares. Oh, I'm sorry, phone calls are 50 cents. You can't afford a clue. Thank God you got cell phones, huh? And it's sad. It's sad. And, you know, I'm also a frustrated stand-up comedian, so I'm always cracking jokes. But, you know, it's based in truth.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that in-depth answer. And I get excited, as you know. You know me for a while. Okay, now let's go back to now it's Mr. Parker's passed away, and we've got these 10th degree black belts, and we've got some people that maybe haven't earned that. But we've got some real kenpo people out there, some really, really amazing kenpo people. Particularly, I think of people like Bill Rozaki, who we lost, Bob White, who's incredible. Just amazing kenpo people out there. Dick Chamberlain, who just recently put on the Gathering of Eagles. And by the way, we went to that together. Just a little insight. How did you feel about that? Wasn't that an incredible event, the Gathering of Eagles in Dallas last year?
Well, I loved it because I've been going to the Gathering of Eagles since 1999, the original one with the Tracys. And very fortunate and very blessed. I've only missed one of them since its inception. And Dick Chamberlain really went above and beyond to really make sure it was a quality event. I mean, everything from he had listings of people's resumes in front of each one of the venues where the seminars were being done. So that way you could read about that person and know about their life and accomplishments and really made it worthwhile. And again, I did several interviews
It was a gathering of amazing kenpo history and people, and that's my next question to Kenpo Joe. I saw three family trees. In most systems, almost all systems, there's only one family tree. Why is there three family trees in kenpo?
Well, there's three
kenpo,
different systems of kenpo. There's actually more than that. You know, I mean,
there's more,
at a glance,
family trees in kenpo? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Explain that to me.
You know, you've got
Explain
Mr. Parker. You've got Mr. Parker's family tree. Well, actually, let's go back to Professor Chow. So, actually, let's go further back.
No,
you have Matose Koshiru
kenpo. I don't want to go past. I don't want to go to Hawaii yet. I've been to Hawaii. I want to talk about mainland, Mr. Parker establishing American kenpo, and then the other sides of kenpo that came in from the islands, and Rozaki influence, Syria influence, so on. But what I'm saying, you're saying there's so many kenpo trees because there's so many different styles of kenpo, and of course, kaiju kenpo being a form of everything. Okay, good.
Exactly.
So, why was there a conflict of, and I saw that night, of people saying, well, I'm not on this tree. How come? Why am I not on this tree? Wait a minute. I'm not under that guy. I'm under this guy. Why was there so much confusion that night?
Human frailty, human error. I made a mistake. I put a wrong name on a wrong chart by accident. Somebody sent me the wrong information. Somebody said that I was under them and I wasn't. Or maybe I had a falling out with them and I'm not with them anymore.
Was your name on that tree?
Which one?
I don't know. Was it there? I didn't see it.
Okay. And as far as Mr. Parker's concerned, Mr. Parker put together the Infinite Insights into Kempo series, volumes 1 through 5.
Right.
That was his masterpiece. Now, that family tree was completed in 1979 and was released in 1981. Ed Parker did not come back to New England and work with the people in New England until 1983. That's why the majority of people from New England are not on that family tree.
Okay.
It's just a simple time frame. He hadn't come back yet. So that's why the Nick Serios and the Clyde Griffins and the Tony and Doreen Cogliandros and the Steve Jellins and me and Leo Lassert and all those people weren't on it at that time. You know, thank God for people like KempoNet who have since upgraded that to let more people know, you know, who is who in the zoo post 1981. And
now,
again, same thing similar with the tree.
With your unique history background and the studies you've done, would you agree that our style, our Kempo in general, is the really first hybrid style of martial arts that came to the mainland?
No. Oh, that came from the that came to the mainland? No, because you know,
that
you look at different
Americanized
Chinese systems.
Maybe I didn't ask the question. The first system came that became Americanized. That's what I wanted to ask you. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, definitely.
American,
I mean, there's
Kempo.
No doubt about
definitely.
That. Right. It was the first Americanized martial art. People say,
now,
"Well, what
that,
about
with
American?"
That said,
like, whatever. No, American Kempo is its own entity.
Okay. With that said, let me go to my next question, Joe.
Sure.
You've got Japanese karate, Okinawan karate, Korean karate, and Chinese martial arts. Those are the four cultures. And then somewhere down the line, whatever year it was, people like Joe Corey and Dan Anderson, other people, Sam Sam, whoever, they created American karate, where they took the best of every system and they formed that. And the Japanese, the Okinawans, the Koreans, and the Chinese never really accepted that. I don't know what years they started accepting it in kata, or they couldn't help in fighting because the fighters are 10 times, a lot of times better. But nonetheless, in kata, they never accepted that. When did you feel that America became part of those other four cultures? So now people say Japanese, Okinawan, Korean, Chinese martial arts, and American martial arts. What year do you think that happened?
I think some people still don't admit to it.
Amen.
As far as that goes, it would Mr. Parker's instance, I would say as early as the 1950s, as early as Ed Parker teaching at Brigham Young University.
I disagree on that. I, like you said, I'd say answer more questions to the first answer. You said that people don't accept it as American karate being part of America. But it is.
Oh, yeah. There are numerous. I mean, there are numerous traditional martial arts that we'll never acknowledge.
There was still prejudice. Now, there weren't even women in karate. There weren't even any women karate in the 50s. I mean, how can you say 1950 being the introduction of American karate being accepted by those four cultures? I thought it'd be much later.
Oh, as far as accepted, who accepted it? Who gives definition of when it was accepted?
Well, tournament promoters. They're making hundreds and hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of dollars because they have American divisions now. You would never think 40 years ago they would have American creative division in a kata or in a karate tournament. It's one of the biggest divisions there in the country. So, yeah, they're accepted that. But you
would
the first
listing.
Where were you in 1963, 64, 65? How old were you then?
Oh, gosh, I was 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old.
Okay.
I was born 1961.
Okay, Joe, listen to me. In that time period, I just said, when they had fighting and they just were allowing, they just didn't like it, but they let people do kata and they compete in kata. So my point is, no, it wasn't accepted in the 50s as being America being accepted as a style as far as people accepting. I really believe that probably not until the 80s. Early 80s,
Gary, I refer to is in relationship to the first version of a quote-unquote traditional martial art that was A, brought to America B, taught in America, and C, was not construed under the traditional listings of karate, taekwondo, or judo or jiu-jitsu. That's what I'm talking about. Now, in regards to its acceptance through tournaments, then you would either have to pick Mr. Robert Trias' early karate tournaments or Mr. Parker's early internationals. Again, there were other individuals around the country who ran other events, but not to the level and not to the amount of competitors that those particular events ran. And again, there were individuals who did not have a lot of martial arts knowledge who weren't black belts. But again, there's a great phrase that I always remember. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Now, if you want to talk about people who Americanized various martial arts and made them popular through tournament competition, personally, I would say, again, late 1960s into the early 1970s. That's when more Americanized martial artists, meaning Americans drawing from different sources, put together their own particular versions of the traditional martial arts with their particular namesake or utilizing some term of America in their name, incorporating that, or taking some variation of a combination of Oriental terminology and Western terminology. That's
okay,
the time frame I would say that
were,
American martial arts.
When you were a teenager in the 70s, right? In the 70s, you were a
yep.
teenager? Okay.
Yes, sir.
You don't know how hard it was to walk into a taekwondo dojo, only have a black uniform, and them literally wanting to beat you up because you just wore a different uniform, let alone not accepting the style that you say you're doing. And then, of course, when you do a Japanese form or a Kenpo form in a taekwondo dojo, they would look at you like you'd made all that up because they didn't accept that. Taekwondo was the only way. So that, going back to my point, taekwondo, even Okinawan karate, and Chinese martial arts didn't accept someone from saying that they did American systems. They weren't friendly to those people. I know I was one of them, okay? I just happened to be lucky enough to study Japanese karate too, so I conformed. But I remember many a dojo I walked in with a black uniform on and even doing my forms, and people look at me and they couldn't argue because karate is real, especially if someone does it for real. But they would make fun because it was different. It wasn't taekwondo or Shotokan, as you say. It was different. So,
well, the classic.
It's a debatable subject.
I'm not debating it. I agree with you wholeheartedly regarding it. Just because I wasn't there doesn't mean I haven't been made aware of the history of Kenpo in this country. You know, again, Ed Parker had a great phrase. Ignorance is the anesthesia that deadens the pain of stupidity. And, you know, those people were ignorant, and all they knew was what they knew. And all they were told was, this is the best, and everything else stinks.
It was so bad that when a few of the people, like I remember Tom Latula and some other producers, Sid Campbell, would even offer a separate Kenpo division. I don't remember what year it was. And besides the traditional Japanese, besides Kung Fu division, they offered a Kenpo division, and I remember a lot of us, we were so elated that we had made it a separation from this. And I tell you the truth, I remember back in the day, a true Kenpo stylist would beat a Kung Fu stylist or even a Japanese stylist, because Kenpo forms are badass, excuse my language. They're badass.
Oh, yeah.
And,
well,
yeah.
They look
like
here's
a street fight that's real. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, here's the phrase that we always said. I competed. I was the first person to compete in black belt division, performing Ed Parker's forms in the 1980s via Crane and the PKL, the Professional Karate League. And I was rated in the top 10 New England doing that. And Mr. Cogliandro, who was the head of Crane at that time, along with Don Rodriguez, were the first people into New England to run separate Kenpo divisions in black belt division. And I was very fortunate to. So, you know, I mean, that's 19 between 1985 to Ed Parker's death in 1990. So that's the time frame for that. And if I didn't compete in Kenpo, guess what? I competed in soft style. So in New England, here I am competing against Richie Brandon, Ho Sung Park,
right.
Ho Young
Park. Nick Gracian, guys,
Yeah, Nick Gracian, John Dufresne from Four Seasons Martial Arts in Kentucky. Yep.
Gary Slatcher,
so these were the people.
Glenn Hart.
These were the people. Right, and Glenn Hart created the PKL. I knew Glenn Hart from 1979 with the AAU, back when when I was also studying Taekwondo and Tai Chuan Dao with John Gabriel, whose student David Collins ended up being a member of the Spider Brand team and later Team John Paul Mitchell. So, I mean, you know, that's how long I knew Glenn Hart for. And real funny Glenn Hart story.
Did you ever drink sake? Did you ever drink sake with Glenn? I did.
No, never had the pleasure.
I remember drinking so much sake that I started making fun of how he combed his hair. Every time I see Donald Trump, I think of Glenn Hart. Does that make sense?
Oh gosh, yeah, I know what you're saying with his hair at that time. You bet.
Yeah.
And matter of fact,
Glenn was a great force performer. He was an innovator. He created the PKL, as you said. Rest in peace, Glenn. God bless you. Now, did you know a friend of mine? We're not going to the legend's name game now, but a good friend of mine we lost a couple of years ago. Real patriot, but great fighter, great kicker. His name is Larry Kelly. Did you know Larry?
I knew Larry. Matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned Larry. Back in the day in the 1980s, like I said, I got my black belt in 83 and I was competing. And Larry, myself, and Pat McCarthy all looked alike.
Yeah.
Same hairstyle, same, some people would say a porno mustache. I don't particularly acquiesce to that. But, I mean, we all had the same kind of mustache. We had the same hair. Matter of fact, when Larry Kelly did a big thing with 2020 about trying to outlaw mail order weapons through Asian World and different companies like that, because I was from Massachusetts, he was trying with Ted Kennedy, et cetera. He had a big thing done on 2020, which I have still on video to this. And, you know, we had a discussion about it, and because I didn't agree, because I sat there, Larry, with all due respect to you, love you dearly, you're not a weapons guy. You know, if I, as a weapons practitioner, want to get legal weapons out of my legal studio, people like you, because you dealt with Ted Kennedy, are screwing me over. Because now I, a legitimate martial arts practitioner, can't get the weapons I need to get. And because Massachusetts is basically a puritanical state, you know, it's still Puritans with the Pilgrims, they, in the early 70s, outlawed nunchaku, shuriken, marugikasari. That was all outlawed completely. It was a 5-year felony if you were found with a pair of nunchaku. You know, but anyway, so Larry and I, you know, we knew each other, and I mean, if you look at this, pictures on my Facebook page and even my old ready for this MySpace page and my old sites that were showing pictures with me and Billy Blanks back in '83 when I was competing, and like I said, same thing with Pat. When Pat McCarthy made the cover of Karate International, Karate Illustrated, people were walking up, hey Joe, I see you made the cover of Karate Illustrated. I'm like, nah, man, that's Pat McCarthy from Canada, dude. But man, you guys look just alike.
Pat,
I go, no,
it was
the 80s.
Let me tell you a fast story about Mr. McCarthy. You know, I'm pretty close to him. And, you know, for people who don't know who he was a great Okinawan stylist and still is a historian of Okinawan.
Yeah, still
so,
is, please.
And when I actually started the museum, he was very close to Uncle Sid, my Master Samurai Shorin-Ryu instructor, Sid Campbell.
Sure.
And this is very personal, so I hope you don't mind me sharing the story with you.
No, no problem whatsoever.
Patrick and Uncle Sid were very close, and Patrick made a luncheon date with Uncle Sid, and he said, look, Gary Lee is going to be going up a hill with this museum idea, and I'm going to do two things for him. I'm going to create a historian award for my EQ society that I have, and I'm going to make him a historian for my society. And the other thing, I'm going to give you my word that I'm going to take care of him. And then 3 weeks later, Uncle said, you know, we lost him to cancer. And right. Patrick called me up, very emotional to me, and he said that he made me the historian for his, you know, his IQ society, which you know about that, I'm sure. And
That
was actually my first knowledgeable notoriety for becoming a historian, and I guess that's what people call me for what I do with the museum. So I'm very, very fortunate that Patrick McCarthy is in my part of my life, and I love you talking about him. And I can see in the early days, you guys looking alike. I can see that, okay?
Oh, yeah.
We were dead ringers for each other. I got a big smile on my face, but I can see that. And now, did you ever fight, Joe? Did you fight in tournaments?
I fought when I first got my black belt. I did okay. Nothing spectacular, no point. Matter of fact, it's real funny. We're talking about Billy Blanks. Barbara Nagel, who you might remember from Ohio, doing Potemkin to Jimmy, Indonesian martial arts. She was very popular on the tournament circuit in the Ohio area and then relocated later here to Massachusetts for the New England area. Well, she was running a tournament called Battle of the Cape Cod Superstars. And I'll never forget, at the time, half of the top people in the United States, who were top fighters of the day, well, from New England. Billy Blanks, Andre Tippett. I mean, you went down the line. So, you know, if you were just like a nobody in New England and you wanted to try to get into tournament circuit, you know, unless you were really had it going on, you had a snowball's chance in HE double hockey sticks. So Bob understood that. So what she did, and this is actually an idea she got from Larry. And what she did is if you lost
– Barbara Nigel, yes. You said?
Yes.
I know
Barbara
Nigel very well, yes.
Yeah. So she ran this tournament back in 83, and this was the year I got my black belt. So she ran this tournament. If you lost in the first round, you paid an extra whopping $5, and you got put back into the flow chart. So I was like, dude, So I see Billy Blanks before, and I go, hey, Billy, can we get a picture taken together? He goes, yeah, sure. I said, can we get a picture? You know, so we did, like, buddy-buddy. I said, hey, can I get a picture of you throwing your sidekick at me? He goes, hey, Joe, why don't we get a picture of you throwing a kick at me? I was like, yeah, right, Billy. I was like, no, really, seriously, I mean it. Okay. And I had good flexibility, so the beautiful kick I'm throwing around, I was kicking his head and whatnot. So I pay my extra $5, and sure enough, first round, I don't get a bye. First match, Andre Tippett. And And for those of you who don't know, former linebacker from the New England Patriots, member of the New England Patriots Hall of Fame. That year, and again, Larry was one of these instrumental guys putting a bug in Tony Coglianjo's year and Don Rodriguez, et cetera. They wanted to make it more exciting. So that year, they decided to give 2 points for a head kick. So I'm like,
what year was that?
I got good flexibility.
What year was the 2-point head kick? What year
1983.
Was that in New England? 1983. It was invented in 1974 at Roy Kirby's tournament. He created the 2-point kick in 1974.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, Roy Kirby, again, well-renowned judge in this country.
Judge Roy Kirby.
Now, I square up with Andre. They go, begin. I hit him with a roundhouse kick right in the head. Boom, 2 points. He goes, 2 points. Now, Andre was a traditional Wei Chi Ru practitioner and had studied another system like an offshoot of Shotokan. So he's going, what are you talking about?
George
Andre, weren't you at the rule meeting? Huh?
He studied Wei Chi Ru under George Mattson up in New England?
Yes.
Good. See, I know
many
my
years.
History, brother.
To this day, out in Norwood. So he goes, well, you know, 2 point. I said, weren't you at the rules meeting? And it was like, so he ends up beating me. And it was close. I was shocked. It was actually close. But I lost, which I didn't expect. So they put me back in the flow chart. But who do I get? Billy Blanks. I tag gloves with Billy. I go, be gentle with me. Billy finishes me with a jump flying sidekick, locks it out literally in front of my nose, less than an inch away, drops down. I look at the ref and go, man, if you don't call that point, I will. And it was just beautiful.
Let me tell you my favorite Billy Dog story. I got to tell it because I'm not bragging, but I think it's really funny. Okay, Billy just had an article came out where he talked about training in the beach on the sand with Army dudes. It was a big article. And he was, he's a great fighter, and I knew him from Pennsylvania back in the AAU days, back when he was with Jerry Durant. That's a long time ago.
Wow. So,
yeah, and I know that's a long time ago. So anyway, so it's the Fort Worth Pro Am. Billy's in the top 10 fighters, and I think Steve Perry. I beat him, and then the next fight was Billy Blanks. And I'm thinking about is that cartwheel kick. I said, there's no way he's gonna hit me with that cartwheel kick. I don't care if he scores with me and kick me in the head, throw me down, stop me. He's not going to hit me with that cartwheel kick. I just tell everybody, there's no way. I practiced against it. I was ready for it. But sure enough, I go out there, we have a clash, and the second thing he does that axe kick. I block it, lands his foot, does the cartwheel, and knocks me out cold. Cold.
No.
And back then, there was no mat. There was no mats, right? There was a concrete floor, the Fort Worth Coliseum. And I hit the floor not only with my head, but also I had Billy Blank's foot that knocked me out. So I had a double hit, knockout plus hit the floor. And I got revived by Smelling Sauce, got up, and, you know, it helped me write my book that I'm writing, that I'm going to publish here in the next few years. I'm probably the black belt that's been knocked out most by anybody in the country, literally.
You know, I don't think a particular accomplishment
years.
You'd want to be proud of.
Well,
but you were there.
I'm
but
not
you,
proud
you know,
of it. I got hit by Billy. You know, that's what I feel about.
Well,
you know, that's cool.
Well, funny you mention it. Since you mentioned him earlier, let's talk about a magical moment. I don't think Billy considers it that, but since we're talking about Larry Kelly, I was at Rocky DiRico's tournament in Waltham in Watertown, Massachusetts. And,
I love Rocky DiRico. I love Rocky DiRico. I love him. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, he had a great event. Again, he also had Cynthia Rothrock and George Chun as special guests there that year. So Larry Kelly's fighting Billy Blanks. And some claim, and I say claim, that Billy never excelled in boxing.
Knocked him out. I saw that.
I was there. People, that footage floats all over the place, but that was released by, it was filmed by Betty Foley and her son Fred Foley, who is another black belt from John Gabriel, released it out into the internet. Now, the only person I was worried, because I had only given that to one person. That was Peaches, Kirsten Sims. And she had done an episode of my TV show. I said, "Do you ever see this?" And she's like, "No." "Oh, my God. Can I get a copy of this?" So I gave it. So when it went out on the net, I was worried it was her. And I contacted her. She said, "No, it wasn't me." I said, "Well, who the heck is it?" And end up Fred Foley finally contacted me and said, "You know, it was me, Joe." I was like, "Okay, well, you own the property. You own it." Okay, I was just worried someone else had done it. But, yeah, so, I mean, and I'll never forget the look, because he hits him with a hook kick, and Billy goes stiff back from the heels. Out. I mean, out.
Right.
And Larry's really psyched about it until he realizes, Billy's going to get up and he's going to kill me. And you can see the look on his face.
Right.
He just brings his hands up and walks away like, no, I didn't mean to do it. It's like, because he knows Billy's going to come back and hit him.
Larry and I were traveling buddies for a lot of the tournaments in the 80s. The Karate Illustrated said we'd be on the same plane together, and we're very close. Listen, I'm going to take a small break, and I'm going to come back. We're going to play the Fun Legends name game. We got a few more minutes, and but I got to take a break here. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back with you. Okay, we go. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You got it.
And be with you right in a few minutes. For my listeners, we're talking to the legendary Kippo Joe. This is Joe Ribello. We'll be right back and play our Legends name game, which is real popular. You know, I really want to share with you something that's real exciting. You know, we've had some great, great martial artists in our country, but a handful of martial artists in the country really, really have done something really special. And I'm talking about one particular pioneer. And that person is a big part of my personal life, my son's life. And I consider him to be an instructor. And I asked him and I called him, if I ever did a fighting competition at Living Legends, may I name it after you? And now you got to remember, Mr. Harrison, Jim Harrison, known as Ronan, the guy that invented blood and guts karate in America, he has to be almost 83 now, 83 years old. And when I told him I was going to name Jim Harrison's America's Challenge, he didn't get choked up or said thank you. He just simply said on the phone, "I'm very, very upset at you, Gary." And he was very, very stern about saying this. So I really was kind of faked out. I said, "Mr. Harrison, why would you be mad at me, you know, if I'm going to do a fighting challenge, you know, at America's Legends this year and name it after you?" He says, "Well, first of all, I'm PO'd because you're not going to let me fight." And I go, "Mr. Harrison, it's not about you fighting, sir. It's about honoring your name and what you've done for us in America and just to name it after your name." He says, "I know, but I want to fight." I said, "Mr. Harrison, when was the last time you put on feet gear? But what was the, have you ever put on something yet? And he goes, of course not. I said, well, it's going to be an entertainment type show and performance, and they're going to be wearing safety hands and feet. He says, okay, I understand. I understand now. I said, well, are you going to allow me to name it after you, sir? And, of course, Mr. Harrison said, I would be honored. So the Jim Harrison's America's Challenge would debut September the 29th for the Mikey Rowe Moore roast that night. It'll be 2 3-minute fights. That's right. It'll be 8 people chosen. And now it looks like it's going to be not 2-man teams, but 3-man tag team challenge matches against the men and the women. Not them fighting each other, but the Jim Harrison American Challenge right off the bat is there'll be 4 clickers or 4 fighters on the side with clickers having clicks for each fighter that fights. The fighter with the most techniques thrown within the 2 3-minute tag team matches will receive a bonus from the Silk Crowder Museum, therefore present the challenge of the sexes without men and women fighting. 1 male fighter out of the tag team and 1 female fighter out of the tag team will be chosen as the Jim Harrison's challenge team to challenge America across the country next year. But it gets better. To be chosen to be in this elite group of fighters, which is 8 of them, you have to have 100 first-place wins under your belt just to be invited. And the judges that will be judging that night at the Living Legends for this incredible moment in time, they all have to have first place under their belt also, 100 of them. Jim Buten, the great Jim Buten, called me up and said, Gary, we got a problem. I'm coming, and I really want to be a part of this, but I only got 94 first place wins. Well, I said, Jim, it's okay, brother. You know, I'll let this slide this year. But, you know, you're going to ever make up for those other 6 place wins so you can officially be a judge? So my point is, this has never been done before. Tag team, black belt, battle of the sexes, named after one of the greatest fighters that have ever lived, Mr. Jim Harrison. September the 29th at the Mikey Rowe Moore's Living Legends Roast, and for Showtime that night for the banquet. Please don't miss it. For more information, you can call directly 713-483-0476 or contact the museum on Facebook, Sport Karate Museum, or Professor Gary Lee at gmail.com, and we'll give you all the information. And by the way, if you're a lady out there that would like to fight in the America's Challenge, you got 100 first-place wins in your belt, give me a call. Guys, I've got 9 fighters already. I haven't choosing them yet, but I can make some more. If you're out there, give me a call. Thank you so much. Living Legends 26, September the 28th and 29th. And don't forget, it's the Year of the Women, the power of women. That's right, the power of women, honoring all the women within the martial arts. Hey, we're back with Joe Ribello and the Legends Name Game. Joe, did you just listen to that little segment?
Oh, of course I did.
Well, let me tell you.
I love the story with my Jim Buten. That's hilarious.
Yeah, a little feature I didn't say, but if my listeners are listening, we've added a brand new rule, and it's because of our dear friend, Mr. Howard Jackson, who we lost many years ago. Howard was known as a blitzer. He had the best blitz in the business and more or less invented that blitz in tournament karate. It was amazing. He used to fight people like Everett Eddy and guys that were twice the size that could close that gap. So here's the new rule for the Jim Harrison Challenge. The center referee has no say-so. All he has to do is break the fight apart. He cannot just say stop. He has to break the fight apart. If the judges, 3 out of 4 judges, see one of the fighters hit the other fighter 3 to 4 to 5 times before the center referee pulls them apart, the judges are going to give that fighter 3 points. Controversy? Yes. Fun? Yes. Imagine being down by 2 points, 10 seconds left. You can win it by a blitz. The spectators know it. The judges know it. The center referee knows it. Most importantly, the fighters know it. So think about the fun that's going to happen. And we're not trying to change it. We're just trying to make more fun out of point karate. And it's going to be the best of the best event without saying you're the best. Well, you are kind of if you got 100 first place wins there, you know. So how do you like that rule, Joe? Is that kind of a fun rule, you think?
I think it's a fun rule, but I got to call you out on Howard Jackson in regards to the blitz comment. You know, I mean, the blitz has always been considered a Kenpo staple. I mean, because simply stated, back in the day, the traditional Japanese judges wouldn't call a Kenpo backfist. So they had to start knocking people out with a backfist. Oh, no power. Well, wake him up and tell him that, would you please?
Because
I think he needs to know once he regains consciousness.
Let me ask you a question, Joe. Did you ever see Howard Jackson fight?
Actually, not in person, but several times on video from over the years. Oh, you bet.
Okay, well, I'm not talking about kickboxing. I'm talking about when he was rated as the very first black brother, okay, ever rated number one. I'm talking about Howard Jackson fighting people who were like 6'4", 230 pounds, and then being that gap between the two X's of, say, 4 or 5 feet. And you're saying people did it like Scott Bessie.
I'm talking
about admitting the blitz across America for people to know how to close that gap. Kipo might have invented it, but Howard Jackson perfected it.
Given, he did. You know, again, and it's, you know, one of the saddest things is that Howard Jackson, unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, and I might stand corrected on this, I don't have any recollection of him ever coming to New England. And again, you know, New England, it was one
was
of those things where the West Coast, East Coast divide.
Is Detroit near New England?
No, nowhere near. It's the Midwest.
Okay.
No, like I said, I don't think he ever came. Now again,
when you talk to me, Joe, you got to have a sense of humor when you talk to me, buddy. Don't you understand that?
I'm a historian. You know historical facts. I'm a
Okay. Let's play the legend's name game. I'll throw some names at you, and you got 2 minutes. If you go over 2 minutes, the horn's gonna blow, and I'm gonna come through the phone. I'm gonna hit you with a right cross you didn't block. 2 minutes. Okay.
Woo-hoo.
On every person. Here we go. Ready? First one.
Fire away.
Ready? Nancy
yeah.
Cereal, my beloved friend, Nancy Cereal. Talk about her a little bit.
Nancy Cereal, the Rose of Kenpo. Most people don't realize that Nick Cereal's crest is a dragon on the front and a rose behind. Again, that was that behind every great man, there's a woman, and Nancy was that woman. She was at one point one of the only women in his school, and she didn't want to be namby-pambied with the girls. She wanted to fight with the guys. And at one point, the guys wouldn't fight with her, and Nick came out and said, look, she wants to be here. She wants to fight like you guys, and she trained like those guys. She fought like those guys. And as someone who's personally been hit by Nancy on several occasions, let me tell you something. She hit just as hard, just as strong, and she was just as deadly as any Kenpo man in the world. You know, she was a woman who later on – I miss her immensely, man. I worked on her video project for one of her black belt promotions for her students, and Nancy was a tough broad. She says that, Joe, I got this lump on my chest. I'm trying to figure out what it is. I'm gonna go, and it's like a hard solid up on her upper chest. I'm like going, Nancy, what the heck are you doing? Why haven't you had that checked? And that's when we started to find out about her cancer and
right.
I knew her from the 1970s. I first met her in 1976 at the Providence Civic Center, where Nick Cereal, in association with Chuck Norris, was running the kickboxing league with the Rhode Island Thunderbolts with Danny Zarbo. That's when I first met her, and I showed her pictures from the program when, man, she was dressed. She looked like Wonder Woman in this Amazon outfit that she was wearing. And
I met Nancy in 93. You remember Young Sung Lee from Hot Mudo? Young
sure.
Sung Lee? Okay.
Yep.
He brought me in and to speak to Jet Fighter Pilots, Submarine. I mean, it was a big deal. And I met Nancy, and she actually was in the limousine that picked me up to the airport. So I got in the back seat, and here's this beautiful woman. She was very pretty. And she introduced herself, and she goes, you're the guy that cuts the cucumbers. And I said, yes, ma'am. And you also break toilet paper. I said, 2-ply. And she goes, and she laughed. And she said, Young Sung Lee has asked us to sit on the black belt board. And I wanted to meet you. So that's why I rode in the limousine to pick you up. And we became so close. And every year at the Sport Karate Museum Gathering, we give out a Nancy Serio Dragon Image Fighting Award to an elite lady that deserves that. So thank you for talking about my dear friend Nancy. I want to talk about someone else from the New England area that I really love and support and really admire what he's done. And it's a twofold person, but I'm going to mention him first and, of course, his lovely wife. But I'm talking about Don Rodriguez and Christina Bannon Rodriguez, who are both history generals for the Sport Car Museum. What's your relationship with them?
Don Rodriguez, thank God for Don Rodriguez. Don Rodriguez, again, I was working for a kickboxing program, television program, with a guy by the name of Ed Cattucci, who was Don the Dragon Wilson's manager, as well as Bonnie the Cobra Camino's manager. And he was, because I was rated in top 10 at that time through Crane, Don knew me, and because I was working with Ed Cattucci, he brought me in to be the announcer for a Christine tournament, the Junior Nationals, and when they aired a cable final show of that, and also was one of the hosts for the television program for the Ocean State Grand National Karate Championships. And I'm very blessed to have known Don. Don stood up for me many times regarding tournament competition. Again, I was very blessed to be associated with him for the IKKA. Matter of fact, I tested along with Christine Bannon Rodriguez for our second degree black belts in front of Ed Parker in 1989.
Wow.
And very fortunate to watch Christine in her early career with this bright canary yellow karate uniform, so she'd stand out whether she was doing. And she was a triple threat because she did fighting, forms, and weapons.
Yes, she was.
She did all three. And later would learn
kung
fu weaponry from Yao
Li. That everyone thought she was an incredible forms competitor, and she was. And she was, you know, wushu plus karate, but she could fight. Man, she won a walk-on world championship. Christina could fight. She was a good fighter. And I'm excited for her. In 2 weeks, we're getting the Eternal Award from Mr. Lewis, you know, Joe Lewis, the Eternal Award. And for her and Linda to receive that, that's pretty powerful. Very powerful to her to receive that, you know, to be honored by the Joe Lewis Award. Well, thank you for talking about them. Let's talk about another friend of mine. I'm playing Russian roulette here. But, man, I love this guy so much. You know, even though he's a beatician, he's one of the baddest Kippo guys I know. And there's nothing wrong with being a beatician. But, you know, people make fun of that because he's so manly. I'm talking about Michael Burton. You know Michael very well.
Of course. Mike Burton, again, just like Don and Christine, Oki Ru, or the Great Ocean Ru Kempo practitioners. I knew Michael in his early career when he was competing. Matter of fact, we competed together in the Black Belt Kempo division back in the 1980s, along with Raven Lee Smith. Michael, whether it was for his empty hand weapons, empty hand forms, his weapon forms with bow staff, or again, a lot of people knew him as a swordsman, like yourself. And matter of fact, we used to compete in Kempo division, and we talked about Kempo katas earlier. And you know what? We always said in Kempo, the ultimate compliment we get pressed at the end of our Kempo kata performance is, man, you're killing people out there.
Yeah,
and you can actually see.
Incredible.
Yeah, and whether it be through the PKL, whether it be through Crane, whether it be through Boyce Liddell's NBL, regardless of the organization, Michael was always out there, and to this day is still a competitor, and has a big tournament competition school in Rhode Island. I have been trying to get him on my television program for decades and still unsuccessful. We're hoping that will change soon. Again, like I said, known him through his association with Professor Serio, his association with Bruce Jutnick later on. Again, a very diversified martial artist and always willing to learn another art, always willing to learn and grow.
But
and
you, know what's make Michael Burton just different from other people? He's a little crazy. And I got to tell you my story. I'll share with you my story. It's Guatemala, 1994. We're down there with Eric Schumann and Yabil Ozaki's instructor down there, and was sponsored by Pepsi Cola. And Michael is just tearing up the divisions. And I'm performing that night with my sword and everything. And there's like 5,000 Guatemalans there. But before the big event that night, I'd won like four of those big, huge temple trophies, right? So I didn't tell nobody except for Bill Ozaki that I was going back to the hotel and Michael. That I was going back. And I fell asleep. So I was gone for almost 4 hours during the daytime of the event because I already competed early in the morning. When I got back and I got back to the tournament, everybody was going nuts. They thought I'd been kidnapped. And they, and Michael didn't say anything to anybody. Neither did Bill. And what it was, when I got back, they put our faces on this huge billboard of Pepsi-Cola. And so they immediately thought, because if you were like a celebrity or something, that people would kidnap you. Well, nobody could find me. And come to find out later, Mikey just didn't tell people because he was just laughing his butt off, thinking that everybody thought I was missing. But I was back at the hotel. He didn't know I fell asleep, but he knew where I was at. So when I got back, you know Stuart Schumann, Eric's brother, the Kempo guy?
I know of him. Yeah, anyway, a lot of Kempo.
He's a good Kempo guy. Anyway, he's also like a mercenary, right? So after I got back, Stuart says, "You're not leaving the site." Because everybody thought I'd been literally kidnapped. So he put a bodyguard with me with a M16. And that night on stage, when Mikey and I and Mike Fillmore performed, Stuart was beside me, didn't leave my side. And I put my arm around him, and Mikey was right next to me, okay? This is funny as heck. And when I put my arm around Stuart to say, I appreciate you being here, I felt the 45 on the left side. As I reached around, there's another 45 on the right. And I went around, I looked at Mikey and said, "Mikey, Stuart's packing." And Mikey goes, "I know. Everybody thought you got kidnapped today. So don't worry about it. Just do the show." You know, I love Michael Burton so much. He was such a joy for me in those early years of competing. And he's a true Kempo stylist. I want to throw a big name at you now. And if you didn't know him, I want you to talk about him a little bit, okay? And I'm talking about, did you ever meet Mr. Norris, Chuck Norris?
Oh, several times.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I first met Chuck Norris in 1976 at the Providence Civic Center for the, I want to say it was a kickboxing league or professional karate league. And this was, okay, this was long before Glenn Hart had used the term. And he was a special guest there. And they were advocating these new type of really, they kind of looked like Kempo gloves on crack. They were really padded and whatnot. But he was there as a special guest of Nick Sirio and Nancy Sirio. And cool. It was really interesting because the first thing I noticed about him, he still said gosh and golly.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. And
right.
He was just so clean. The classic clean cut, all-American boy, blonde hair, you know. Just the way he looked was like the classic all-American clean-cut kid. And then years later, I met him at the World Cup of Martial Arts. And this was run at Foxwoods. And I was working for Ed Cattucci, and I was one of the announcers for the event. And I remember that Professor Sirio was placed as bodyguard for Chuck Norris. And Chuck Norris was one of the special guests, and the other guest was Don Wilson. And there was this enormous line because of popularity of Walker Texas Ranger and what went on with that.
Sure.
So to meet Chuck, and there wasn't as big a line for Don, nothing against Don. It's just the way it happened to work out. And I remember that at the time, Chuck and his then-fiance, who was an aerobics instructor, had just been on Howard Stern. And Howard Stern was going on, as Howard Stern will, and he was going on about the ring that that Chuck had given her, which, if I'm not mistaken, it was like $124,000. It was so we were at the nighttime show, and I was actually sitting next, literally, to this Texas oil millionaire. I kid you not. And I had this poster that sadly this young lady who was suffering from terminal disease, her mother worked at a video store, got me a copy, and ironically it was Chuck Norris's film Hellbound, where he portrays this occult hunter and whatnot. But anyway, so I pulled it out and I explained the situation to Chuck, and he signed it for me for the little girl, and I looked over and I saw his fiance there. I said, so I forget her name right off the top of my head. I said, "Hey, show us the ring that they were talking about on Stern." She flashes it. I go, "Oh, my gosh, Chuck, you could flag down small aircraft with that thing."
Wow.
And,
well, you know, that's
yeah,
Chuck Norris hadn't changed in all the years that I've met him. I met him in the early 70s, and he's never changed. And I'm very blessed for him to be a part of the journey of the museum. I got one more for you, and we talked about him earlier, but we didn't really go in depth. And I'm talking about someone that we lost this year, the great Al Tracy. I mean, your relationship with Mr. Tracy.
I first met Mr. Tracy. I have my television program, Martial Arts Today Television. It's been on the air. This October is going to make 29 years. And there was a gentleman by the name of Rob Wager who had a Tracy studio out of Wittenville, Rhode Island, Wittenville, Mass, which is like right on the Wittenville border, is the Rhode Island border. So I found out about the seminar, and it was rare that Al Tracy was ever in New England. There was only two other people that were Tracy people in New England, one guy by the name of Chuck Palmer, another guy by the name of Pedro Bennett. They were the only people. So anyway, I went to the event, and, you know, he was suspect and prospect because I was a Parker person. So he was talking. He was talking about some person he was angry with. It wasn't me, and he was just talking about them. And suddenly, he fired off this thrusting sweep kick, dropped into a twist stance with a sandwiching elbow. Whoop-ah! And I was like, there's Ed Parker! And he stopped and looked at me for a moment. I said, sir, that's the ultimate compliment I can possibly pay you. You move exactly like your instructor. You know, most people had seen him move from the videos, but they had never seen him explode. You know, when he heard that, his whole attitude changed. We ended up talking for like 8 hours with each other. Did a great episode. Matter of fact, it will be airing on YouTube probably within the next 30 days. And then so fast forward to 1999, I go to the Gathering of Eagles, and I ask him specifically, is anybody recording it? Oh, yeah, we got somebody filming it all, and da-da-da-da. Nobody filmed it. So after that event, John DeLuca, who is a friend of mine's, another Tracy black belt from Massachusetts. I got to mention him. That's why I didn't list him initially. Was talking to Miss Tracy, Alan Pat, and he's like going, "Hey, didn't Joe Ribello interview you?" He goes, "Oh yeah, we had a great time. We talked for hours. It was awesome." He was like, "Well, why don't you hire him?" He goes, "You know what? That's a good idea." So in 2001, they hired me to be the recorder and shoot interviews and shoot like 10-minute interviews in the 10-minute action segment. Well, there were so many people that I couldn't do it along. And another gentleman, John Patrick Nieto from the New Mexico area, he became involved and he did some of the interviews as well. I don't know where his footage is. I know they were passed along to Al and Pat. I know I kept copies of my stuff and obviously gave copies to them. I'm hoping to release some of those now that Mr. Tracy has passed because we have shot other interviews. And even the Last Man Standing event in Texas, you know, story time right. with Al Tracy. So we've pieced it all together. But I was so fortunate.
He was a great guy. And the first year of the Last Man Standing, when I actually got to see you after all those years, you know, his son came up to me, Mark, and said, "Mr. Tracy, we'd like to speak with you." So I walked over there, and, you know, I've got a 7-3 black belt on Mr. Tracy that was signed by John Chong and, you know, Mr. Braverman, all those guys up in Pittsburgh and stuff. And I'm very honored by myself as buying from him. And he said, "Gary, I have something for you." And he gave me the Kenpo ring that he designed of the tiger and the dragon. And he says, "I appreciate what you're doing for the history of sport karate. And this is just a little token to say, I really appreciate what you're doing." And that really, I'm looking at it right now. It's very personal. So, but, you know, we're almost done, but I've got to ask you, I've had a great show tonight talking about the history, and I apologize if some of the listeners don't understand why when I raise my voice, I get excited talking to you, Joe, because you are a historian. I get excited talking to people that know what they're talking about. It's like a little kid on Christmas morning. So I'm apologizing, but not really, because you know me, I get excited. So I'm going to ask you this one last question. And it's just a personal one. You've been a part of the museum now. You're a history general. How do you feel it's important, the work that I'm doing, and for to keep the history in front of everybody about sport karate? And, you know, the cultures are important, and there's people who are doing that. But there's not anybody who's doing sport karate in America except for the museum. And how do you feel about that?
Well, again, where would we be without sport karate? Where would we be without tournaments? Where would we be? I mean, really, in many ways, this is the melting pot. You know, you talk about Americanized martial arts, and you've watched tournament karate in the last 50-plus years, and you've seen how it's changed and grown. And, you know, I hear a lot of people give a disservice to it, you know, the baton twirlers and different things like that. And I go, you know what? That's innovative and creative martial arts. That's taking things to the next level. That's going above and beyond the traditional, classical, traditional, and bring it more into the eclectic and modern martial arts. I was involved with people, like I said, like John Gabriel, who back then we were doing Chinese martial arts with Okinawan weapons.
So it's important.
And man, I'd watch
the
traditional have brain aneurysms about it.
Joe.
Say again?
My question. how important is it to keep it documented of sport karate in America
critical
for the future generation? Okay.
Critical. I mean, we talk about the legends such as Howard Jackson. People need to know this. In our day and age, when we have a student walk in and they don't know who Bruce Lee is, they don't know who Jackie Chan is, they don't know who the Ninja Turtles are, you know, unless they're watching Nickelodeon, you know, they need to know about the history. They need to know about these men and women
who sacrificed their time.
With
the end of the show, I want you to make me a promise that you'll always be there for me 24/7 when I need a question about Kenpo, because I certainly can't do this by myself. And I've got 250 history generals like you that I depend on, but I don't have a lot of people in the true Kenpo people that I can dig history that understand the Japanese philosophy along with the Chinese philosophy, along with the Kenpo philosophy. And I think tonight, no, I know, tonight on the show, if anybody listens, they understand that you're one of those people that, like myself, that understands the history of all of it. And I appreciate you being on the show tonight, and we're running out of time, but I just want to say to you, you keep doing what you're doing. Keep being the historian. And if anybody wants to get in contact with you, what's your phone number?
Sure. You can reach us at Reed Bellows Kenpo Karate in New Bedford, Massachusetts at 774-360-4116. You can email me at kenpojoe@aol.com. Check us out on Facebook. Check out TV shows out and instructional videos on YouTube. And just look for Kenpo Joe.
Wow. Again, thank you for being here tonight. I love you with all my heart. I really do. You're one of the true historians, true Kenpo practitioners. And even though you only made black belt in 83, which is a long time ago, you're still an old fart to me. I love you.
We're just a couple of fart ninjas,
Joe.
Silent but deadly.
Yes, sir. Good night, Joe. On behalf of the
Have a good night, Kenpo Salute. Have a good night, everyone.
Yes. On behalf of the AMNA Masters Radio Network and my producer, Hansi Jesse Bowen, please, we'll see you being your home next Tuesday night. And thanks for letting us come in tonight from all of us from the Masters Radio Network. Mahalo and aloha.